Now, it's important to say, Benedict composed this rule for his own monastery. Gregory I admired it and popularized it with his biography of Benedict. And therefore, it began to spread and spread and spread and spread. We'll encounter it in later lectures. It was particularly prized in early England, and English missionaries promoted it on the continent. Anglo-Saxons influenced the Franks, whose greatest king, Charlemagne, imposed the Benedictine rule on monasteries all over Europe. So gradually, the humble effects of Benedict in central Italy were quite accidentally, and quite without his having intended this to be the case, spread throughout much of Western Europe, and then even to the world beyond. So we have church fathers who deal with great intellectual issues. We have monks who in some way opt out. Let's conclude with some reflections on the final question I posed at the beginning of the lecture. So what? How did Christianity affect culture and life? Well, we might notice, for example, the Christians continued to use Greek and Latin, thus assuring their preservation, and enriching them with new vocabulary, with new conceptual frameworks, with new things to talk about. Christians added much to the vocabulary of both Greek and Latin. Now, what should I think? Signal and then not press too hard. The old thesis of the very famous German scholar Adolf von Harnack, that classical culture captured Christianity. Remember Horace's great remark about Greece, that captive Greece took her captor captive? In a certain way, von Harnack saw classical culture having done that to Christianity. The fact of the matter is, and I've signaled this in connection with Augustine's book on Christian doctrine, that the Christians knew how to spoil the Egyptians. Yes, they took much from the classical world around them, but I think they did not succumb to it, and I think they did not compromise with it over much. Let's emphasize, for example, a slightly different kind of issue, Christian patronage. Remember I signaled the end of the great Roman building boom during the 3rd century, during the period of crisis? When we come to the 4th century, remember I signaled that Constantine gave the money to build St. Peter's in Rome, to build St. Paul's in Rome, that he donated the land on which the Lateran Basilica eventually rose with, again, his support. This began to happen all over the Roman world. Christian patronage put an end to the building bust of the 3rd century, and over the 4th and on into the 5th, the most splendid edifices built around the Christian world in city after city after city after city were their cathedral churches. Now, gradually, these churches and other public spaces, and sometimes even domestic spaces in homes that might once have been decorated with sort of floral scenes or might have been decorated with pictures of classical motifs, stories from the Iliad, stories from the Aeneid, wherever the stories might have come from, now began to be depicted with scenes from the scriptures, with traditional scenes or sometimes even legendary scenes. In other words, a Christian art began to emerge. Yes, it used certain classical artistic motifs. Yes, it continued to use mosaic, setting tiles in wet plaster. Yes, it continued to use fresco, painting on wet plaster so that the painting became part of the wall. Yes, some of the figures look much like the figures in classical pictures, but the fundamental themes were different. And gradually, a Christian art that was something old at once, old and new, began to arrive. Christian poets carried on the classical tradition. Indeed, in the 4th and the 5th and the 6th and the 7th and the 8th and in the 20th century, Christian poets have written poetry that can stand comparison to the best that was written in the ancient world. I signaled this a few minutes ago in connection with St. Ambrose. Christianity did other things too. It took the very curious step of assigning enormous power to celibate men. But it did this at the same time in a world where it said all were equal because all were sinners. So in a democracy of sin, celibate men were accorded great power. Here is a fascinating paradox, something old and something new. Christian martyrs and saints created new kinds of hero figures. Martyrs, of course, famous for how they died. After Christianity was granted toleration, saints famous for how they lived. But here were new heroes, not the heroes of the Iliad, not the heroes of the Aeneid, but new and different kinds of heroes. A new morality assured women a more secure place in society. The morality that applied to men was applied to them as well. Slowly but surely, Christian ethics pervaded secular law. We'll see some examples of this in later lectures in more concrete terms, but suffice it to say that secular law began to be marked by Christianity. So the lands that had been the western provinces of the Roman Empire had evolved into a series of kingdoms, often enough as a result of Roman policies. A church that was barely visible in 180 at the end of the Pax Romana has become regnant, triumphant in the Roman world. A culture that had produced a small number of writings about which there were deep controversies at the end of the Pax Romana has become the dominant culture of the Roman world. These are the paradoxes of continuity and change in the world of late antiquity.